Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
What came to me was, you know, you are, you know, now a Hollywood producer, right, of a certain age, you know, and you say, what do I want to do? Well, you go back to your golden age of being 12 or 13. You say, this was something I cared about. I wish I could be part of the excitement of making this thing that I love and that I care about. And so I am going to use now the position that I'm in to bring that thing that I love and I care about to the big screen or to the small screen now or whatever it was, you know, and I think that you know, for these sort of biggest and sort of loudest megaphones that are the movies and the TV that you're talking a lot about, I think that happens a lot. So I think, you know, when you're seeing now the adaptation of a lot of the things that I loved when I was, let's say high school, sort of college, a little post-college, those 90s Vertigo comics, Sandman, Preacher, things like that. You know, I'm the age of a lot of the people now who are saying, hey, this is amazing. Of course I would want to be able to make a Why the Last Man series. Who wouldn't want to see those comics that I loved when I was a kid on the screen?
Hello, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving. It's that time of year, which we love very much here at The Realignment. And what we usually do is we do a special episode. So that's what we decided to do today. Marshall is a big comic book fan and actually found a great guest with a great book. So Marshall, what are we talking about today?
Yeah, this actually came from a comment on the Substack. We like it when people respond and engage and do stuff like that. And this person said, hey, like, it's an interview show. I get it, but I'd love to hear more content that's about your personal interests, like what's going on. Like, not everything has to be political. So right around the same time, a publicist reached out to talk about American comics, a history. This is with Columbia professor Jeremy Dalbert. And this is just a really interesting conversation. It's Thanksgiving, obviously. I'm going to be spending a lot of time on HBO Max catching up with a variety of superhero properties that we haven't hit. Sagar, at some point we'll do an episode that's of your personal interest that we'll air it during a holiday season part, but a lot of really great stuff here. And this is just a really interesting, honestly interesting conversation that ties in well to our conversation about why is our culture the way it is? Why does it feel like everything is a reboot of a reboot of a spinoff of a reboot? A lot of really great stuff here. Really interesting conversation. So many things to really think about. And look, if there are other topics that aren't strictly political, that are just purely culture, entertainment, health, lifestyle, definitely let us know what we should talk about, because we would love to do lighter fare like this when it's a holiday, when there's something that isn't quite as much in the news.
Don't forget, guys, in order to subscribe to the Realignment Substack, as Marshall mentioned, we always take comments and we actually react and, you know, really are very responsive to that. Of course, the Realignment Bookshop, you can buy both this book and many other books there of many guests of our own personal interest. There's lists that are included. And as always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Let's get to it.
Jeremy Dalbert, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here with you guys.
Yeah, good to see you, Jeremy.
Thank you. This is coming out on Thanksgiving, so I hope everyone is having a good time and has the opportunity to take a bit of a break from family to listen to an interesting episode that's a little outside of our wheelhouse. Let's start with what feels like a contradiction at the heart of any conversation about comics. The stories that we're telling here obviously dominate American and global box offices, culture, TV ratings, streaming services, all those things. At the same time, it feels like the actual medium of the comic, whether it's in a book form or whether it's in a newspaper comic strip, is irrelevant. Do you agree or disagree with that characterization?
I think I would disagree with that writ large. I mean, I think that, you know, as a particular genre of the superhero, the one that, as you say, is doing a lot of the work in that box office domination, sometimes it does feel like the movie cart is driving the comic book horse. But in terms of the medium of comics itself, as a venue for telling sort of wonderful stories about personal identity and growth and all and history, things that appeal to kids, you know, I think that the medium is as vibrant as it's ever been.
So that's an interesting perspective, because like Marshall said, you know, I'm not into comics necessarily, but obviously a lot of American pop culture is centered around Marvel and has become a lot more familiar with it. What do you think that says about comics themselves? As in, why are they such a unique and good way in order to drive home storytelling, which is obviously very compelling?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great question, because I think that first, you know, it really gets to comics not as a genre, like we're saying, but as a medium, right? As a way of putting out stories. And that interesting combination of images and text that sort of put together in a sequential fashion, usually, which is how we sort of talk mostly about comic storytelling, is something different from all sorts of almost any other art form. And in one way, it's because it really allows readers to do a lot of imaginative work by putting together those pictures, those words, by putting together the space between those still pictures and having the reader give the sense of action and motion in a kind of way that really allows for the interplay of imagination. And this is all, the only things here we're talking about is all just about formal properties of comics, right? Just how comics work. We're not even talking about yet what the stories themselves do. And the stories can provide sort of the opportunity for putting yourself into those stories, identifying with them in ways I think that are often easier because of the drawn nature of comics than, let's say, the photorealistic representations of most movies or television shows or what have you. So there's a way of finding yourself in Superman or Spider-Man or Wonder Woman, or some of even Raina Telgemeier's little girls in her children's graphic novels, that is easier to do than even sort of some of the most compelling and resonant movies, let's say.
I want to go back to what you said at the start of the episode around comics being as vibrant as they've ever been, because that is going to feel surprising to most folks. So when you define vibrancy, are we talking volume of sales year over year, popular discourse, zeitgeist? Just explain further what you mean by that.
Yeah, and I think the answer to that is yes, you know, in the sense that we have first tremendous amount of sales in the, for example, in the children's book market. Raina Telgemeier, who I've already mentioned on this, someone like Dav Pilkey, who do these Dog Man graphic novels. These are everywhere, you know, sort of in, and when I say everywhere, this is also a change from certainly when I was growing up. You can find them in your public libraries in massive sections. You can find them being taught in schools in a way that they weren't being. So there's that aspect, and that in more of the elite precincts of the culture, we're also having the comics medium being taken seriously. A new graphic novel is going to be reviewed in the New York Times Book Review. It's a competitor for something like the Booker Prize. Comics can win National Book Awards. So all of these different elements are contributing to the idea that comics are really a central part of the conversation in all these different kinds of ways.
I don't know if you saw this, but Substack, the newsletter publisher, has started onboarding comic book writers to the platform using the advanced system they've used in other formats, which brings up a question of how these programs, not programs, but how these ideas, stories are actually distributed. What do you think about people coming on Substack and probably leaving big publishers?
One of the stories that I try and tell in the book, that I have this new history of American comics, right, that's coming out right now, that's out now, is the story of how comics is not just an art form, right? It's not just a medium, but it's also a business. And so much of the story of how comics has evolved has been about the businesses that it's been associated with, that it's been involved, that have published them, that have competed with them, that have trained, all of those things. And comics, the medium, is like water. It really goes into all of these new media as they develop. So the internet has been remarkable in many different ways for comics and ways we can talk about. But it's not surprising that one of those stories is creators constantly trying to find a way of figuring out how to get their work out there. And of course, how to make a living doing it. And not just as a means of personal expression, but also as a business. And Substack is just the latest in these iterations of that process. And I'm very interested to see how that is going to work itself out. I suspect, like a lot of new business endeavors, it will work quite well for a couple of people, but it won't be a sort of a mass model. People are still going to be very much attached to the kinds of, roughly speaking, to the kinds of processes that they had.
Yeah, I'll admit to being skeptical about that operation. But one thing I'm curious to get your perspective on is what makes an American comic American, right? So there are Japanese comics, manga, anime, all this stuff, which, you know, if anything, actually now has a cultural footprint here in the United States. But it's undeniable that we have a distinct style, and in many ways maybe have even created it. I'll also want to get your perspective on that. What makes American comics American?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, one of the things that happens in the book is that there's really the putting together of two different kinds of definitions of that word American comics, right? The first is the history of comics that were basically speaking published in the United States, right? And so they're American in that kind of way. But that gets confusing because, for example, Watchmen, which is really a high watermark in comics, was published in America, but it was and it's about America, but it's written by two and drawn by British people who have a very Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, who have this very, very outsider's perspective on America. But it is an American comic, I think, in many ways. So there's mm-hmm. that's one side of this, right? The other side is that part of the story that I'm telling in this book is the story of how this material reflects and is shaped by trends and currents in American history. So, for example, when you look at comic strips that come out of the Great Depression, the Great Depression was a golden age for comic strip period, right? So many of those comics reflect in one way or another, either the circumstances of the Depression themselves, or a kind of escapist desire to try and get away from that, to have these grand sort of adventure strips. The first age of the superhero is inextricably lined up with World War II. And a lot of these superheroes are either proxies for fighting the Nazis, or they are ways of sort of saying, let's not think about the Nazis, let's focus on things at home. They help sell war bonds, right? So all of these things are connected with American history in that way. And as you were saying before, a lot of these comics go out, they fundamentally influence comics in other countries, some of which have their own already extant traditions. And then those comic traditions also come back, particularly as the world gets smaller, and influence American comics as well. And all of those parts of the story sort of appear in the book in one way or another. And we can talk more about them. We've got plenty of time.
Yeah. And speaking of the world getting smaller, a good way of telling the second half of the 20th century after World War II is that ideas around soft power, cultural exports become increasingly important. So the fact that the U.S. can birth these products and export them becomes important. Same thing of Japan, South Korea, insert Squid Games reference. Something I'm curious about, as you think of these cultural exports, what makes a product, not just comics, but what makes these types of products work in broader audiences? Because if you think about it, China and India are huge. They have cultural products. Everyone knows what Bollywood is, but there isn't like a Bollywood property that has taken over a non-expat market.
Yeah, well, I certainly can't speak as well to what has happened from other areas coming here. That's not really my area of expertise. But since we're inserting Squid Game references, I think we're seeing how certain kinds of conventional wisdom about how things didn't necessarily work for American audiences are being kind of overturned in real time. And certainly that was the case, Sagar, you referred to this, I think, earlier with manga, that about 15 or 18 years ago, manga admittedly manga really came and really I would say almost dominated a lot of American comics. And in part, the back and forth of this, we can talk about translation, right? Where certainly there are a lot of people in other parts of non-America who know English. There are not maybe as many people who know Korean or who know Japanese. And so you have to have the translation kind of catch up to that. In a certain kind of way. But nonetheless, and in fact, some of the influence of manga in early American superhero comics, things like Frank Miller and Daredevil and things, was originally without Frank Miller understanding what the actual words were, right? Because comics is a visual medium, he could say, look, I just read, and he had that in quotes, this 100-page manga. I didn't even know what it said, but I could still tell what the story was. And that was extremely powerful there. Right. You compare that to a 1950s comic of Superman. If you can't understand the words of one of these science fiction-y Superman stories, you really wouldn't be able to know what was going on in the story. You might enjoy the images, but you wouldn't really know what was happening. Increasingly, manga was very influential in that kind of way. So, you know, I do think, though, getting back originally to your question, Marshall, or this part of your question, I think that some of the things that comics do best are some of the things that all kinds of great art and great literature do best. So the super, which is to say, speak to things that are universal in the human condition. And so, for example, so much of that early superhero wave, which then, right, were about these questions that animate certainly all of the children in us, not just the children, but the children in us of what if we were really powerful? What if we were really strong? What can we do to fight bad guys? What could we, you know, how could we make things fairer for other people? Right. These were a lot of the questions that animated Superman sort of in those early years. And I think those resonated. Batman is saying, you know, I'm a human being. I'm not extraordinary like Superman. There is trauma in my life and I want to try and use my will to make good. This is a story that really can have transcultural properties. And it's not surprising that Batman, for example, there are wonderful art books of different countries' versions of Batman, sort of bootleg versions very frequently, that are all sort of over because this is a story that you could, that really does have these mythic qualities to it that could resonate. But I don't know that that is any more or less resonant than any, than other art forms, but it is equally so, I think.
Why do you think certain types of, not even comics necessarily, but properties, go and have mass cultural appeal in some places, like abroad, and then some are just limited, like you said, to the US? One of the things we're thinking of is like Marvel is huge worldwide, in China especially, and even India. But Star Wars, for example, is just not one that really seems to translate. Why do you, or Star Trek is another one also that doesn't seem to have as big of a global cultural footprint, at least maybe in China. Why do you think that that is? I mean, like what makes, what is unique to the American, one type of American comic, which is flat and applicable worldwide?
You know, as you're saying it, I'm trying to think through this question. Yeah. It's not a question, you know, the book is mostly focused on American stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it strikes me that the answer is if people knew, there would be a lot more billionaires in the business even than there are.
Yes.
Because, you know, Star Wars is basically a comic book, right? It has a lot of debts to comics. We can go into the details, but all sorts, right? It became very successful as a comic book version, for example.
We've got a question about this coming up, so we'll hit it. Don't worry.
Oh, okay. But I'm taking, so that didn't do well, but you could have imagined that it could have done well. On the other hand, going the other way, I don't know that you would have predicted that Squid Game would have done as well as it did. I don't think anyone did. Right. But of course it did. So a lot of these things is sort of hard to figure out. What I will say though, is that increasingly technological platforms really allow for the possibility of this experimentation in a way that wasn't the case before, right? So you really can say, we're going to put this material out there, see if it finds an audience. If it turns out that it does find an audience, we can make more of it. There are going to be a lot more Squid Game oriented shows that are going to come down the pike in the future. Some of them I'm sure will do fine, some of them will not. And that's always a fun thing to watch too, is how different kinds of modes and ideas go in and out of vogue. So for example, one of the stories I tell about in the book is how horror comics sort of come in and come out. There are external pressures too, but come in and come out. And that kind of, with horror, you can almost see subversions of that where, you know, The Walking Dead hits, and then there are 5 million zombie shows, right? And vampires, which were really big in the 90s, you know, there was True Blood, but there's not that much vampire stuff nearly anymore. I'm waiting for them to come back. They'll make them.
No, it doesn't need to come back. One of the more cringe times in American culture. I do want to focus on that, though. Can you give us the maybe like a cyclical structural overview of how and why that happens? Because you're so right, and I think it's very interesting as to how, you know, Squid Game obviously followed up I think was preceded by Parasite winning the Oscar here. And it kind of showed that a class-based South Korean message could possibly translate to the West. So in a way, it was predictable, but also obviously it was a gamble. And now it's going to open up an entire new slew of these, you know, of entertainment products in the U.S. Can you give us the previous examples like that, you know, delve a little bit into horror and then maybe how it delved into subgenres, vampires? Because I think that the timeline on that is important to actually understand, like, metacultural pop trends, which are, you know, seem to be happening. And you're like, why is this happening? And you seem to at least understand the pipeline of how it works.
Well, you know, I think one of the nice things about writing a cultural history rather than being predictive is that you can sort of see how those things ended up working out, how the trends and the material came together. So, for example, right, horror comics really flourished in the period immediately after World War II. This was the time period. And as a part of that, I mean, you can tell a story about the way in which, you know, on the one hand, you know, the greatest generation had just defeated Nazism, right? And they were coming back, and they were sort of trying to settle back, or back, and I'm putting that in air quotes, to some kind of constructed version of normality. But there were all of these lurking anxieties. There were anxieties because of the social stresses that had been occasioned by the war. A lot of people didn't come back. There were economic stresses. Divorce rates were up. There was social juvenile delinquency kind of things. A lot of this manifested itself in a subterranean unease that made it particularly fertile ground for a kind of horror comic which focused on scratch your white picket fence and there are poisoners and bigamists and homicidal killers and all this sort of lying underneath, right? And then that stopped in no small part because of an external shock. That is to say, there was kind of a moral panic over the horror comics and it put it down. So these things don't necessarily, to use our metaphors, not die a natural death, right? Sometimes they're murdered. You know, but you can tell, you can understand why horror comics kind of came out at that period as a way of, through culture, expressing some of the anxieties that weren't necessarily there to be sort of expressed sort of quite as vocally, let's say. Right. Again, and it's a combination of these institutional factors and social factors. The horror comics might not have been as big if there weren't some very talented people spearheading sort of the production of these comics, right? That's sort of been part of it too. In the 1970s, there's another boom in horror comics. Part of that is perhaps because of some of the post-Nixonian anxieties about sort of the faith and sort of the American experiment about post-Vietnam. Right. Part of it is also that this comics code of authority, who had pushed down on these horror comics after the 1950s moral panic, let loose a little bit. And they said, okay, you can publish some of this stuff. And all of these people who are working in the industry, right, this is, for us, it seems like a long time, 50s to 70s, but really we're talking about 15, 16 years, right? Say, oh, I remember these things sold like gangbusters. Why wouldn't we try a lot of this again? And so they try it again, and it sells pretty well for a while. And, you know, one of the things that's fun to do in the book and just in general thinking about these things is to try and come up with these multivariable explanations of the right people sort of finding the right institutional circumstances and then being able to ride the right wave of social ferment in order to create it, right? So that's just one sort of set of examples from the 50s to the 70s. I'll just add one last one, which was that in the mid 80s to the early 90s, as we were alluding to before, there's a kind of a British invasion into American mainstream comics. People like Alan Moore and Neil Gaiman and what have you. And most of these people, these Brits, came from a very politicized anti-Thatcher environment in the 80s, where they genuinely felt that Thatcher was mad, right? They thought that she was insane, that she was genuinely terrifying. And so there was a lot of kind of political horror kind of coming in there. And that kind of politicized a lot of the American comic business in a way that it had been, you know, not explicitly political before. Comics have always been political, right? Always. In every sort of way. But this was a way in which, you know, you have Thatcher being name-checked, you have Reagan being name-checked in certain ways and things like Watchmen and other things. And that develops a different kind of horror boom in the late 80s and the early 90s.
It's really funny. I'm thinking of, and you'll know this, Alan's Batman comic, where it's an old Batman, and politics aside, like the portrayal of like Ronald Reagan is like very interesting, because it hasn't aged well in the cultural sense, in the sense that like in the movie, like not the movie, but in the comic, Reagan is this almost like nefarious force. And as American pop culture has evolved, he's seen as this like 1980s figure that has been memory hold to certain degrees. So it's really funny to rewatch and reread any of these properties in a 2010s, 2020s context.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, and again, this is also part of the story of the treatment of politics within sort of these American comic book industry, where, you know, for if you read comics in the 50s and the 60s, even with, you know, you're not going to say anything bad about the president of the United States, right? It's not going to happen, right? And then even sort of in the post-Nixonian 70s, there's still, you know, there can be an evil president, but we don't want to really identify him necessarily in quite the same way, right? By this point, you know, by the 80s, by the 90s, certainly into the, right, you're getting much more explicitly political. You're getting much more willing to take on the government and sort of say that the government is a bad actor in all sorts of ways. That really is a change, partially because, again, there are these institutional factors where something like this Comics Code of Authority has been, its influence has been lessened, where they would, you know, and there are sort of institutional factors like comic book stores that allow for the selling of comics that don't need to have any sort of public seal of approval on them at all. You can be a lot more daring and a lot more also adult, because if you're a 9-year-old reading a Superman comic, you don't really care about any of this stuff. You just want to see Superman fight a giant robot that Lex Luthor has started, right? But when you're in your college age, let's say, or you're older, you say, well, you know, what's really interesting is the way that some of these stories can be told in light of a complex, much more grand narrative involving structural, institutional factors, political factors, what have you. And that came with the aging of that mainstream comic book audience as well, right? You wouldn't have been able to tell those stories in that kind of subtle way that you're talking about to people who are, you know, 8.
And a question, I want to take it to the Star Wars thing before we move on, because it brings to mind, you know, you're referencing what Lucas was inspired by. He was inspired by Buck Rogers. He was inspired by Flash Gordon. People have probably watched Dune. It's hard to look at Tatooine and not see Dune with Frank Herbert's properties.
Right.
But aside from Dune, and that was a property that took a while to develop on a couple of different levels, almost no one remembers Buck Rogers. Flash Gordon had a couple attempts to be brought back into the mainstream. Didn't quite work. As you're cataloging this history, what are some, if there's some Hollywood producer listening right now, what are some forgotten properties where you're like, man, different circumstances, that would be a huge thing or could be a huge thing?
I'm going to tell that Hollywood producer to go out and buy about 10 copies of my book and sort of distribute it to their entire staff. And you can see lots of ideas there. You know, I, but you should also listen to this podcast, by the way, Hollywood producers out there, please listen to this one. But I do think that you're absolutely right, Marshall, that the world of these comics is full of these forgotten gems and hidden treasures in all sorts of ways. And what's interesting about them is not just that, as you said, something like Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon, that they have all of these sort of stunning visual storyboards that your Hollywood producer could then turn into their landscapes, right? But they're also very much products of their time. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done in order to really remove, let's say, some of the racism that really inflects
Ming, who's the emperor.
Yes, that's great.
It's Sagari. Can you explain who Ming is?
No, you're absolutely right. So, you know, in these Buck Rogers and both these Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, basically they're of this sort of 1930s sort of science fictional moment, right? And this is really the beginnings of science fiction as we kind of know it today, modern science fiction, of which Star Wars is a very prominent inheritor in a certain way, right? Of which, you know, sort of strong-limbed white guys with Ivy League backgrounds basically save the day from people who don't look like him, right? And so you have these bad guys with names like Ming the Merciless, who are like these embodiments of this sort of Orientalist, sort of anti-Asian kind of, as they used to call it, yellow peril kind of terrible things. And so a lot of that stuff is really very quite regrettable. You know, tremendously regrettable. And it was also, I think, one of the things I point out in the book, which I think is, you know, is important, is that fundamentally, these were many of the images of Asians, particularly East Asians, but Asians, that were being seen by Americans all through the country, right? Nothing was as widespread as comic strips at this point. In the country, right, on the cusp of World War II. And it may not be surprising as a result of some of this anti-Asian material that when the United States fought the Germans and the Japanese and they were represented in comics, the Nazis were represented as bad people, right? But they were represented as bad people. And the Asians, the Japanese, were represented as sort of these subhuman monstrosities. Visually represent. We were talking earlier about how the medium can tell a story, right? And really, this is what you have. You have this. They're not are people who have gone wrong and they're terrible in this. But the Japanese, they're not even people, right? And this is something that you know the artists and the writers of that era have a lot to answer for, quite frankly. Hmm. Even within you could have had an opposition to you know the Axis without of sure. course engaged in that.
Let me get your opinion on this, Jeremy. My friend Paul Scalis, also known as the Lindy Man, has a meme online, which has actually become quite popular, which is that culture is stuck. It's not an original point that he makes, but everybody does kind of feel it. All we get are remakes of remakes. Everything is a sequel. It feels like the world really hasn't moved that much since like 2008 from a meta pop cultural perspective. Do you agree with that characterization? Like, is there a vibrancy, as you're pointing to? Because why do so many people feel that we're just getting recycled versions of things in the past? Live action Disney being the best example.
Well, my theory about this, and I remember this coming, this was maybe 10, 15 years ago, this is when I developed this, was that there was a Dukes of Hazzard movie. I don't know if you guys remember.
I remember that movie. Johnny Knoxville's attempt to be a live action actor. With, Sean William Scott. Very
Jessica
important.
Simpson, just right? Very,
she was. Yeah. We just. I did not see it, but
we,
I remember.
We were in seventh grade when this happened, so we were the prime target market for this movie.
Yeah.
Well, you can answer then this question for me because you were the prime. Yeah, I'm older than you. You were the because I was like, who is going to watch this? You know, in other words, who says yes? I remember the Dukes of Hazzard. That's what I wanted to see on the big screen. And what it struck me, but maybe Marshall, maybe the answer is you know people. But
Jessica Simpson is most of the answer.
The real answer is idiot 13-year-olds. Right, right. But yeah, right.
But what came to me was, you know, you are, you know, now a Hollywood producer, right, of a certain age, you know, and you say, what do I want to do? Well, you go back to your golden age of being 12 or 13. And you say, this was something I cared about. I wish I could be part of the excitement of making this thing that I love and that I care about. And so I am going to use now the position that I'm in to bring that thing that I love and I care about to the big screen or to the small screen now or whatever it was, you know, and I think that for these sort of biggest and sort of loudest megaphones that of the movies and the TV that we're talking a lot about, I think that happens a lot. So I think, you know, when you're seeing now, the adaptation of a lot of the things that I loved when I was, let's say high school, sort of college, a little post-college, those 90s Vertigo comics, Sandman, Preacher, things like that. You know, I'm the age of a lot of the people now who are saying, hey, this is amazing. Of course I would want to be able to make a Why the Last Man series. Who wouldn't want to see those comics that I loved when I was a kid on the screen, right? So I think that's where the lag is. So I am always waiting for, as it's beginning to happen now, the people who are a little bit below me to start sort of making the things that I was too old for. Now I'm no
idea. Interesting. You know, what's so helpful about what you said is A, your theory is correct, but B, like
there was something going on in 2004, because 2004, you have a Starsky and Hutch terrible reboot with Owen Wilson and Ben Stiller.
I actually like that movie.
You are an audience of one on that one. You have that reboot. You have I Spy. There actually was like a huge glut of 70s and 80s thing. But I think this is what gets to Sagar's point, which is that you're referencing the 70s. You're referencing the 80s. You're referencing the 90s. There's just a He-Man reboot on Netflix. But when people are talking about culture, what they're kind of getting at is this idea that we stopped having those reboot. We stopped producing new things around 2000. So how do you think of the golden age aspect of this discussion?
Well, you know, as I was sort of alluding to, there's a wonderful sentence. I don't remember who came up with it. Maybe someone will. But, you know, that the golden age of science fiction is 12. Right. And that to me is the truth of all this. Right. Everybody has their own golden age. And it happens to be when you were precisely wide open to these kinds of things. There are going to be people, you know, you'll have me back on this podcast 15, 18 years from now. People will be like, you remember Dog Man? Dog Man was a classic. Let's have Dog Man on the big screen. Like, you know, that's what, it, you know, and they're going to say, and maybe they'll be right. You know, all I'll say is that if you actually look at a lot of the, you know, some of the work that's being produced now, the work that is currently under the radar, because it hasn't appeared on the big screen yet, it's the people who are falling in love with it, who are 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, that work is out there. There's some great examples of it. There's, you know, and I think it's going to influence sort of the next generation.
Let us get your perspective on an interesting question, which is, why should comics not be in the public domain? And what we mean by that is, you know, Aesop's Tales or the Brothers Grimm, you know, I'm trying to think. There's all the classic
Cinderella. Think of Cinderella. It's in the public domain.
I thought
domain.
That was Disney. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Okay. Well, you see, okay, it's a Brothers Grimm tale.
So if we think about it from that perspective, these kind of timeless pieces of art that can then be iterated on in any fashion by whomever wants. What do you think are the costs and the benefits of that type of IP model? And I know it's sensitive because, you know, artists and all of them obviously should own and have control over their work, but there is a cost certainly to things being vertically integrated by all Disney, or so to speak. So I'm curious what you think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I would say, as we were saying before, and, you know, and the book talks about a lot of this, that so much of the history of comics is a struggle between sort of creators and the corporations to have control of their work, and alternative models of comics business. We've been talking a lot about superheroes, those kind of big sort of IP properties. But of course, you know, part of the history of comics that showed the way for sort of a much greater degree of business sharing or profit sharing than ever came before was from these alternative independent comics that said, you know what, we're going to publish these things ourselves. We're going to create our own characters and all these kinds of things. So you know, that struggle has always been playing itself out and continues to do so. To the extent in which, you know, now you have a lot of creator owned characters. So if there's if there ends up being one of the new modern classics is the Saga, this sort of Star Wars meets Romeo and Juliet in outer space by Brian Vaughan and Fiona Staples. You know, you can certainly see this becoming a major streaming series. And if it is, those two, I hope, will make a ton of money, because they deserve it. That said, I'm going to give you my gut feeling about this, right? Which is artists and writers, generally speaking, have made a lot less off these products than they should. So there should be a long runway in which they get to make a ton of money off these things. After that long runway, I think these things should then go into the public domain. There could be lots of discussions about how long that runway is and exactly when it works. That, you know, the devil is, and the big devil is in a lot of big details, but I think that as two general principles, I think those are right. There should be a time at which Mickey Mouse, I apologize, Disney, but I think there should be a time at which Mickey Mouse should.
Yeah, I agree. That's from 1930 or whatever. Like,
so this, you know, and what ended up happening, I think, in the history of comics is that the public domain question became very, very mixed with the creators' rights questions. So Superman is a 1938 character, right? I mean, he's not that much older than Mickey Mouse, right? But on the other hand, you know, the creators behind him really were not compensated in any way close to the success of what that character could be. You would not say the same thing, of course, about Walt Disney or about Walt Disney's heirs. So as those conversations about should these belong to the world going on, you know, you could have a very justified conversation about, and they had, but it's like, well, shouldn't they have gotten a chance to belong to the creators some too? And that is the case, I think, with the overwhelming majority of those big blockbuster characters that we're still sort of talking about. The last thing that I'll say is that we're also now in a period, because of that dominance of culture, where it seems that almost any character from this gigantic, robust universe could be a billion-dollar property, which was something nobody expected, right? Superman comes out in 1938. By 1940, you could tell that Superman was going to be a big hit, a big property. No question.
100%. Interesting.
But when I will say this, and I don't think I'm alone in this. When Marvel Studios announced that they were going to make a movie about the Guardians of the Galaxy, in 10 years ago or whatever it was, a lot of comics fans probably were like, Guardians of the Galaxy? Really? Them? This is like, at best, these are C-list characters, right? You know, we were all, those of us who felt it, we're all totally wrong.
Great movie. Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah.
Great movie. Made a ton of money, right? And so now, you know, every character could have this fight, right? It's not just going to be Spider-Man, right? Everybody is a potential billion-dollar property.
What I love about that is you're just getting at, if anyone's like particularly interested in this part of the conversation, I suggest people really read about Marvel Studios in the 2000s, because the interesting background here is that Marvel as a comics business was a disaster in the 1990s. They basically sold what they saw as like the big properties off the studio. So they sold the Hulk to Universal. They sold Spider-Man to Sony, the X-Men to Fox. And all they had left in the late 2000s were the second tier characters. So Iron Man, once again, billion-dollar property now, second tier at the time. Thor, all these people. And this is where Disney deserves, because we just said that they should lose their IP. This is where Disney deserves praise in this episode. What they did so successfully at a business level is take second-tier properties that weren't thought of as being valuable and really made them really, really big, to the point where, which is bigger, X-Men or like the broader like Marvel universe there? Then at Fox. The other way around. I'm just curious how you think about how the big properties have stewarded it.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, I would be criminally negligent if I did not say on this podcast that I tell this story in my book, and that you should.
Why people will buy it.
Please go out and you can read it there. But I agree with you. I mean, I think a huge kudos goes to Kevin Feige, goes to the people at Marvel Studios. This is what they have done is to me one of the most, maybe even arguably you could say the most incredible trick in the history of American mass culture, is to be able to sort of shepherd these dozens of movies. Now we're getting on, you know, probably dozens. It's going to be dozens of television shows or streaming shows, you know, lots of other properties into one gigantic, really interlapping narrative almost in every way. And to really convince people that this is all part of the story. You really want to pay attention to all these different aspects of the stories and make all of this money doing it. I can't think of anything like this that's even close in the history of American pop culture. This is not like, I mean, one thing that you could have said a while back was that superhero movies were like Westerns in the 1950s, right? If you turned on your screen, right? You'd watch Westerns everywhere. It was on the big screen. They were on the small screen. You could say, okay, superheroes are Westerns. But none of those Western universes had anything really to do with each other. Yeah, John Wayne was in a lot of them, right? But they were all different movies, right? What they've done is just really recapture that embroidered complexity of the Marvel universe in many ways on stage. It's just a remarkable, not only business accomplishment, but in its own way, you know, an artistic accomplishment, an aesthetic accomplishment. Individual pieces of it are better than others, but it's amazing.
Something I'm curious about, and I'm not asking your political opinion of this, I'm actually just curious about how you describe this as a business phenomenon. There's been increasing emphasis in the broader cultural debate around wokeness in comics. So for example, Superman's son just came out as bisexual. You're seeing Marvel really diversify their heroes. Miles Morales becoming Spider-Man, Kamala Khan as Miss Marvel being a Pakistani immigrant. How to what degree have these new properties revitalize the industry. So were they successful in their own terms on bringing new folks in, or do they largely serve? So, for example, like the Superman coming out issue, there's all the Fox News segments, but that was a record selling issue. That being said, I'm still skeptical in 2 years from now if that energy is going to be maintained to the same degree.
Right. So I think it's a great way of framing that question, right? And I think, you know, again, in this history of American comics that I tell in the book, there's a history of lots of different kinds of people who have not been represented in many of the mainstream comics and in many comics, and how their stories are told and how people get to tell those stories sort of as comic book history goes on. So this is part of a very ongoing story that's been going on for many decades. But as you say, you know, there are two elements to that. There's, let's call them, the aesthetic element and the business element. In terms of the aesthetic element, I think that part of this marginalization that had happened for such a long time was the marginalization of certain kinds of stories. It's no less than that is saying, you know, anyone who reads comics is in the business of wanting to hear more stories, more different kinds of interesting stories. That's why we want, we just keep coming back for these things. And so why wouldn't we welcome the opportunity to have all sorts of a broader canvas, a more robust canvas to have these kind of stories? And it just is the case that when you get more different kinds of storytellers in the mix, they are going to come up with angles and things, you know, that people who don't have those experiences or those perspectives would ever have thought of. And that's, you know, that just sort of is a function of just having more people in the room. And when you have characters, as we've been saying, who've been around for 70 years, 80 years, 90 years, you know, there are a lot of stories that have already been told. So any opportunity to get sort of a different angle on those things, I'm quite pro. The business angle, I think, is complicated. I think the story, the jury is a little bit more out on. That is to say, I think that it's hard to, I think that, you know, that best-selling issue phenomenon that you're talking about is very frequently, it's hard to sort of separate out from the kind of speculation in comic book issues, the financial speculation that often happens when there's an event kind of issue. Or something which simply, and this could be something that says, you know, I am interested in this for my own sort of personal reasons, that this does resonate with me, but it's going to be a one-off, right? I'm not interested in this as more than sort of something that speaks to me for this one time. That I don't know. The jury's going to be out on some of that. I do think that as the demographics of the United States are changing, there is going to be an aspect of which people want to see more people who look like them, however you want to define that, in some of these stories. And that is going to be good for business, as I think it always is. But I think one of the most interesting comments I saw about this, not precisely on this, but sort of indirectly, was by the producer, and I was talking about this in the book, was by the producer of Black Panther, the movie Black Panther. And this was an interview he gave before the movie came out, before it was a huge box office success, before it became sort of, you saw the Wakanda salute everywhere, right? Before that, he said, look, I think of this as a Fast and Furious movie. He says in this interview, he says, people don't come to Fast and Furious because of the ethnically diverse cast. They don't come to it because they don't like the ethnically diverse. They come to it because of the cars. They want to see, and our job is to give lots of big car chases. And if we do that, people will be, that's why they'll be happy. And I think that in some ways, a lot of these things are going to be secondary. I think that was right for Black Panther. It wasn't the only thing that attracted people about Black Panther. But if Black Panther had been, let's put this, a very bad movie, it would not have had the resonance.
Yeah, it wouldn't have done well. Right.
I think that all of these elements that we're talking about are going to be, in some sense, only complementary to if it's a good Superman story or it's a good Ms. Marvel story. And I think if you have that, it's going to be phenomenal. And thankfully, you know, many of these stories are being told, people like by G. Willow Wilson, who really, you know, put Kamala Khan on the map. right? Who's the Ms. Marvel? You know, she's a great writer. She's telling a great story, and it's a grounded story. And that's what made those, to me, those books sing.
I agree with you. I've always just been like, listen, just make the content good. You know, that's the most important part.
Yeah.
You also wrote a book about comedy. I'm very interested in comedy. Friends, luckily to be friends with some pioneering comedians today. What do you think about, and this is your previous book, which we'll also put in the show notes, about the state of comedy where we're at? Your previous one was Jewish Comedy, A Serious History, which, you know, it's funny having be friends now with some comics, many of whom are Jewish, who look to previously like Jewish icons in comedy as inspiration for why they got where they are today. I'm curious, you wrote that book in 2017, a 5 year later check-in. What do you think about the state of the industry, of the medium, all of that right now?
Well, you know, I think that going back to sort of you know, your guys' real interest in sort of institutional platforms, mm-hmm. and things, you know, something that was really only beginning to start, I think, when I finished writing the book, let's say 2015, 2016, before it went to press, was that the streamers were really sort of jumping in with both feet into the
yes.
process, right? That is really, and it seems like maybe they're jumping out a little bit again. I'm not sure. I've been spending a lot more time with comics than with comedy the last few years. But certainly that has really, again, sort of revitalized the stand-up as a kind of thing where, you know, with something like the Bo Burnham show, where you're seeing something that's even a little bit more produced, a little bit more filmed version of this. I think that has really been the thing that I would have had to spend a lot more time on, a kind of a new stand-up generation and sort of a new audience for that. That would be the biggest note I would make to myself, I think. Sounds like you wanted to say something, Sagar.
No. I was just... I think you're right. It's fascinating to me because I think we're both, like you said, the high water mark of that was probably 2018. And now I think we're actually beginning to come out of it. I'm starting to see some skepticism, pushback. What happened with Dave Chappelle is actually, I do think, is kind of a across the Rubicon moment for many of these people. And if anything, it will make it so that a lot of streamers will be more reluctant to pick up something which will be, you know, controversial or not, you know, especially if somebody's not the size of Chappelle's audience, which will actually then push people to where my career was made on YouTube. So I actually think we're going to be seeing a lot more direct to video consumer stuff. What do you think, Marshall?
And just quick pick up a question.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about the 2017 to 2018 period you're describing, Jeremy, is that it seemed like comics could have their cake and eat it too, in the sense that you could sell out. But it's not as if you're going to Comedy Central. You're going to a big streaming platform, yeah. and there's views, and it's cool. And it seems like people are readjusting their expectations of what you can and can't do on a big platform that's more generally audience, that's more focused on an audience beyond just your specific fans. So I'm curious how you just think about that dynamic.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that you're both right to say that one thing that I imagine, I'm not talking to the people in those rooms, but that they're taking away is, why pay $37 million or whatever it was for something like, you know, which is, when even a Bo Burnham, you know, you're charging close to a tenth of that, or a little bit more than a tenth of that, you know, you're getting it. And what you could get 15 people, 10 or 15 people just for that, for Bo Burnham money, and they would be delighted to be on there as well. I think you're right, Marshall, to say 100% that I did not spend as much time then on YouTube stuff, certainly on TikTok, which I don't even remember when TikTok started. You know, a lot of that stuff as really being a launching pad. I talk a little bit about Rachel Bloom, who then sort of jumped to the CW. But still in 2016, 2017, I was thinking, well, that's the path. You know, you start here and then you go somewhere else. But now with the YouTube, with the influencer model, and sort of the, you know, you can be an incredibly successful person just on those platforms, you know, and that's fine.
You can sell out arenas. I see this happen. I mean, one of my friends, Andrew Schultz, literally, it was one of the first YouTube comedians and is now consistently selling out like 3,000-4,000 tickets a night per city, you know, wherever they're going in the U.S. So it is a big sea change.
Yeah. Yeah. So that part, I really, you know, if Norton came back and said, you know, you want a second edition of Jewish Guy, these
you
would
should
be,
do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, right now we're kind of the first edition of American.
Right. First, let's sell this book, then we'll sell the next.
And we'll go back. Right. Yeah. But
so let's close out on something you said. You referred to speculation when it came to first editions. I hear speculation. I think crypto. I think Web3. I think NFTs. How has the narrative, because once again, this stuff is so early that I can't even be too empirical about this. How is the narrative around digital spec? I got an email from DC Comics, like, get your first collectible Wonder Woman NFT. It wasn't an actual NFT.
Really?
It was it's
oh, it wasn't a real NFT. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's not a real, it's just like a nice digital picture, but there wasn't a blockchain. I didn't pay anything for it. There wasn't Ethereum. Right. So that was them seeing this early version of it. But just close out with how you think this new phenomenon, this would definitely make the second edition of this book, is impacting the industry.
Well, you know, I think that
I hate to do this. I have to give a quick example.
Yeah, please.
Quentin Tarantino just got sued by Miramax because he's attempting to create an NFT of his first script for Pulp Fiction.
I didn't know that.
So I want to add this. So this, because this goes back to what you were saying earlier about the tension between the creator and the company. So yeah, we just love your big thoughts as we close out. Yeah.
Well, you know, my big thought would be that, you know, and this ties back to the Substack kind of thing. You know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is the history of sort of comics getting onto the internet. And a lot of that story is full of false starts and sort of experiments that don't quite work, and that eventually things begin to coalesce around certain kind of models of how digital will work with comics. So, for example, you know, it's pretty clear drawing directly onto digital, you know, you're making works directly onto digital platform, that's going to stay, right? People are going to draw digitally from now on, right? Are comics going to be read primarily on digital platform? Really still an open question. I think with a lot of this stuff, you know, you could imagine people, creators, taking pictures of themselves with their comic book in hand and kind of that selling that as an NFT. You could imagine all sorts of different experiments. I will confess I don't know enough about a lot of that stuff to even be able to speculate. But I imagine that there are going to be, if the history of comics is any indication, there are going to be wild bubbles that are going to end up making a couple of people some money and a lot of people it's not. That would be my guess.
Yeah. Well, it's been really great talking to you, Jeremy. The book, we're going to have a link down in the description where people can go and buy it. It's just been very edifying conversation.
We talked about this before.
Go ahead and hold that up.
This is great. We do not normally advertise book covers, but this is an incredible book cover. So we really recommend American Comics: A History.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.